Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the Deathcast. I'm going to be sharing with you guys here in the free feed an episode from the Patreon feed. This particular episode is the first episode in my coverage of the Columbine school shooting. Give a trigger warning, there's topics discussed in this episode that may upset some people. But if you enjoy what you hear here, you can go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to content just like this, exclusive content, but also early ad-free shows, the opportunity to suggest cases for me to cover on the shows, and also to ask questions about things that I'm covering to get a deeper understanding about the things that I am discussing. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. $1.99 a month gets you access to everything. Hello, and welcome to the very first Patreon exclusive episode of the Deathcast. What do I mean by Patreon exclusive? Well, you guys give your hard-earned money every single month to this show, and I want to make certain that you feel like you're getting your money's worth. So, when a case comes up that I want to cover that I do not want to cover in the normal free feed, I am going to be covering it here. And this first case is one that I have publicly stated I will never cover in the free feed because it has to do with a school shooting. And specifically, it is the Columbine school shooting that took place on April 20th of 1999. Now, before I get into the who, what, when, where, and whys of this crime, I'll explain to you why I do not cover these types of things as a general rule of thumb. It has been shown through data that publicizing these types of crimes, these mass shooting crimes, actually perpetuates furtherance of these crimes. This isn't something that I came up with. This is actually something that many people much smarter than I am have done the research on and come back with the conclusion of that if Johnny Smith goes up and shoots up a school and the media jumps all over it, by publicizing not only the perpetrator's name, but the amount of individuals who were wounded and or killed, and their reasoning behind perpetrating these crimes, it inspires other individuals. Now, the same thing can be said to be true about serial killers, as there are a small amount of them who have admitted to having been inspired by other serial killers. And to give you a good example of that is John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy stated to investigators that he drew inspiration for his crimes, how he committed them, how he got rid of the bodies, the possibility that he may have been involved in a sex ring that sold boys out of state, from the crimes of the Houston mass murderer Dean Corll. Dean Corll is known to have had accomplices in his crimes, and when Gacy was arrested, one of the first things that he is quoted as having said was, "Who else did you arrest?" leading to the belief that Gacy may, in fact, have had accomplices in these crimes. He also drew inspiration from the fact that Corll is known, although for the most part law enforcement refuses to acknowledge this as fact when all of the evidence points to this, that Corll was selling boys to a national ring operating out of Michigan, headed by one Francis D. Sheldon, who was a multimillionaire with ties to the babysitter murders in Michigan. Sheldon was found out after an island that he owned was raided by law enforcement. There was a day camp going on there that was set up under the guise of helping underprivileged youth, but in reality was transporting boys around the country for use as sexual objects. Now, some of these boys may or may not have been killed. We really don't have information on that because, unfortunately, the crime happened so long ago that it is very difficult to get files on that particular series of crimes. But regardless, Coral was shown to have had links to this organization that Sheldon was the head of. Sheldon ended up fleeing the country and dying overseas, reportedly still committing the same types of crimes that he had been committing in the United States. So these people, they do inspire one another. The difference with school shootings and serial killers, however, is that nearly all school shooters state that they were in fact inspired by a previous school shooter. And point of fact, most of them state that they were inspired by the events of April 20th, 1999, when Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold opened fire in Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. And I do not want to help perpetuate that type of crime where innocent children are being murdered by fucking losers who feel that the world owes them something, or who have so low self-esteem that they crave attention from others to the point that they need to go out and kill individuals who have had no opportunity to have experienced life in any way, shape, or form. I'm going to give you a little bit of my personal belief on things as far as murder goes, all right? The two worst crimes in my view are child abuse, rape, and murder. To me, they all fall within the same category because the individuals involved in those particular crimes are unable to defend themselves in any way, shape, or form. And if they are, quote-unquote, simply abused, they have to go the next however many years that they live with carrying around the trauma and horror of what was done to them until the day they died. Child murder falls under the same category for me in the regards of these individuals have not had the opportunity to experience life. The other major crime to me that is worse than any others is simple rape, because the individual being subjected to the assault has to carry it around with them for the rest of their life, unlike someone who is an adult and is a murder victim. Yes, it's horrible that they have been murdered, but they've at least had the opportunity to experience some semblance of life, and they're dead. They don't have to keep reliving that trauma over and over again. School shootings fall in the same category as child abuse, rape, and murder to me because the children who die have not had the opportunity to live life, but more than that, the individuals who survive have to carry that trauma with them for the rest of their lives. No matter what happens in their life, they will never escape that. I don't care how much therapy they have. I don't care if some computer whiz creates a program where they can completely wipe somebody's mind and remove those memories from them. Some small part of their mind is going to always carry that with them. And that is why I refuse to perpetuate the school shootings by covering it in the main feed. I don't plan on turning the Patreon feed into a school shooting only feed, but I feel that this is a case that needs to be looked at because there's a lot of misconceptions concerning this case and the reasons why the perpetrators carried them out. I'm going to start that off right at the beginning. The FBI labeled Eric Harris as a psychopath. Now, there are some lesser psychologists who have refuted this idea because of Eric Harris's age. However, when this was initially presented by the lead FBI agent on scene at the time, who went over and did the FBI side of the case, all of the psychologists who heard his assertions based upon the information and the evidence presented to him agreed that Eric Harris was a full-blown psychopath. Now, what is a psychopath? A psychopath is an individual who has no emotions. All right? They are able to mimic the emotions of other individuals based upon what emotions they have seen these other individuals display, but they have no real emotions themselves. They do not view other human beings as having any form of worth or right to live other than to serve them, and the whole purpose of their life is self-gratification, be it from manipulating other individuals through their lies or through causing and inflicting financial, sexual, or violent pain on them. In looking at Eric Harris's writings on both his website and in his journals, the FBI was able to rightly conclude that Eric Harris was one such individual. He had no sense of empathy. He had no sense of sympathy, although he was able to mimic these characteristics in order to manipulate those around him, particularly the adults that he interacted with, such as his father. Dylan Klebold, on the other hand, was not a psychopath. He was an extreme depressive who longed to be accepted and, in his own words, wanted to know the love of another human being, particularly a woman. That is what he pined for most in life. An aspect of this case that is oftentimes overlooked is that both Klebold and Harris were extremely intelligent individuals. And when I say extremely intelligent, I'm talking they would have been members of Mensa had the two of them survived and decided that they wanted to be members of it. They were both massively intelligent, which is why, or one of the reasons why, Klebold felt like such an outsider and was so depressed. You see this time and time again with these individuals who are just so massively smart that they are literally light years ahead of their peers. They don't fit in, they don't feel a part of, and as a result, they end up in a depressive state, which they fuel with the use of drugs and alcohol, both things that Harris and Klebold are known to have partaken of, because in the case of Eric Harris, where he drew joy from manipulating those around him, the use of alcohol also allowed him to feel something that was real. The exhilaration of being out of control of himself. Dylan Klebold used the alcohol to numb the pain that he was feeling and that he felt that he could not adequately express to other human beings. And I want to say, after having said that, I am not exonerating Dylan Klebold for his actions, but it does need to be understood at the start of this thing that Eric Harris was the main perpetrator of this crime. And in Dylan Klebold, he found the perfect piece of clay that he could mold to his own ideas, under the guise of friendship, which is something that Klebold desperately needed in his life. And we're going to get into that as we talk about the various journals that the boys left. Dylan Klebold was an extremely lonely individual. He felt like the perpetual outsider. Both boys had this mentality, but Eric Harris used that and reveled in the fact that he was an outsider. He was not a depressive, whereas Klebold was a depressive and was looking for any form of acceptance that he could find, and he found it in Eric Harris. Now, Eric Harris had the ideas for a school shooting long before Klebold did. However, Klebold was the first of the two within the writings to mention killing other people. Harris wanted to kill other people because he saw them as being less than him and without worse, whereas Dylan Klebold saw it as a means to the end. He had spoken of committing suicide numerous times in his writings, but he also saw killing others as a means to getting himself killed and thus take him out of the pain that was life. I do not believe that Dylan Klebold would have perpetrated this type of attack had he not had the catalyst that was Eric Harris. I also believe that he may have attempted to commit suicide if Eric Harris was not in his life, although whether or not he would have succeeded at that is up for debate. But I don't believe he would have intentionally harmed other people, gone through with this idea of, you know, killing others that he mentioned in his notebooks, if it had not been for Eric Harris. Harris was the straw that stirred the drink in this dyad. Now, with that in mind, there's a couple other things that we need to keep in the back of our minds as we proceed with our story. The most important of which is that not all of the information collected on the Columbine perpetrators by both local law enforcement and the FBI has ever been released. In fact, a large amount of it has not been released despite numerous requests for Freedom of Information Act by various reporters, because there's something in there that they don't want out in the public, and, you know, we are left to speculate on what that is. The other reason that not all of it has been made available is it came to light many years after the fact that there was, in fact, a cover-up by local law enforcement in regards to the Columbine massacre. So a lot of the information that we have concerning this case comes from the dogged pursuit of said case by a reporter by the name of David Cullen, who wrote what can only be described as the Bible in terms of the Columbine case. This man was on it from the start and doggedly pursued the case for years after the fact. Littleton, Colorado is really a suburb of Denver. It's a very affluent area, and the majority of the individuals that we're going to be encountering during the story come from affluent families. Now, both of the perpetrators of this crime were born in 1981. Dylan Klebold was actually a native of Colorado, whereas Eric Harris, whose father was an officer in the Air Force, was born elsewhere and moved around quite a bit during his early years. Now, there is some speculation among the psychologists that this constant uprooting may have, in fact, helped turn Eric into a psychopath. However, the majority of the materials I have read when it concerns psychopaths is that they are born rather than made. That's not to say that outside influences may not impact their level of psychopathy that they experience within themselves, just that they are born that way and there is nothing that has been shown to reverse or negate that particular aspect of their personality. MRIs and CAT scans have been done in studies on psychopaths, and it shows that their brainwave activity does not resemble that of a regular human being. In fact, one set of results, when shown to others for peer review, was responded to with, "Why are you showing us the brainwave activity of animals?" That should give you some idea of the difference between a full-blown psychopath and your average everyday human being. They do not have joy receptors that light up as they do in a normal human being. The normal stimuli does not make their brain work. Instead, different parts of the brain, specifically those concerned with thinking, light up when they are presented with a similar situation. As stated, both of the perpetrators of this crime were extremely gifted. Dylan Klebold was in gifted classes almost from the start, as was Eric Harris. Eric Harris was born Eric David Harris on April 9th, 1981 in Wichita, Kansas. As stated, his father was an officer in the Air Force, and the family moved around very often during his early adolescence. He began school in Beaver Creek, Ohio, but also lived in places like Oscoda, Michigan, and Plattsburgh, New York. It's known that he went to at least 5 schools before his family eventually settled into Littleton, Colorado. Kathy Harris was a stay-at-home mother. They had another son, an older child by the name of Kevin. It's been said that Wayne Harris, while outside of the home, was an outgoing father, coaching his boys in various sports as well as being a scoutmaster, was an extreme disciplinarian. I don't know whether or not that means that he beat the children, but the indications I have seen, that does not seem to be the case. According to the book Columbine by David Cullen, quote, "Wayne reacted to outside threats in classic military fashion, circle the wagons and protect the unit. He didn't like snap decisions. He preferred to consider punishment carefully while the boys reflected on their deeds. After a day or two, Wayne would render his decision and it would be final. It was typically grounding or loss of privileges, whatever they held dear. As Eric grew older, he would periodically have to relinquish his computer. That stung. Wayne considered a conflict concluded once he discussed it with Eric and they'd agreed on the facts and the punishment. Then Eric had to accept responsibility for his actions and complete his punishment." Now, there are many contradictions within the media to this day concerning Eric Harris. He was described as a loner who was picked on by the jocks in his school, and this has been perpetuated to this day. That is absolute bullshit. Eric Harris was a fairly popular student. Remember, he was a psychopath. He was able to mimic human behavior perfectly, and he was also an extrovert, at least as far as anybody knew. He was said to have a sly, gregarious smile, to be able to pull women at will and to really just generally get along with everyone that he encountered. He was known growing up to be extremely enthusiastic about sports, and despite later depictions of him as an arduous racist, his best friends from early in his life were described as being minorities. He was also an avid sports fan, following baseball and football religiously. Growing up early, it was said that Eric was shy. However, as he came into his psychopathy, particularly once the family moved to Colorado, this began to change. And that's when he really becomes this, you know, gregarious, get along with everyone extrovert. At least on the outside, he was still extremely private and kept his thoughts and his feelings to himself, at least the ones that he was actually feeling. It was noted by various coaches and teachers that Eric was an individual who had to be goaded into participating in particular events when there was a fear that he might fail. And that was because, again, Eric, in his mind, thought that he was greater than everyone else and he could not allow himself to face failure. It's also been said that growing up, Eric had a very active imagination that really centered around murder. And murder in this case involves military maneuvers, be it against swarms of alien hordes or against more traditional human-based forms. Regardless, the taking of other life forms was always present in Eric's earliest fantasies. With the advent of really graphic computer video games, particularly Doom, Eric Harris found, at least for the time being, an outlet for these fantasies that he was having. And I want to point out, I'm not saying that the video game was responsible for the actions of Eric Harris, only that he found an outlet for the things that were going on inside of his head, wherein he could act out those fantasies without going out and actually taking lives. In 1993, Eric's father retired from the military and the family moved to Colorado, where they would remain for the remainder of Eric's life. In essays that Eric wrote, especially with the help of hindsight, it is easy to see that Eric was a master manipulator, even at such an early age, as his writings, where he describes things such as the tranquility of going on fishing trips with his father, to be the absolute best experience in his life. And I say that he's a master manipulator in this with the hindsight of 2020 vision, because we have been able to see some of his other writings, the ones that he kept hidden from everyone. And the image of the way he viewed the world and those around it, including his own family, is vastly in contrast to what he presented in papers that he turned in at school, where he tried to project this idyllic version of reality to the world. And oftentimes he was able to snowball his teachers into believing the things that he was writing. Well, I have no doubt that Eric did enjoy doing these things with his father. I believe it had less to do with the interactions he had with his father and much more to do with the excitement of the victories that he was experiencing during these particular outings, be it in baseball or in fishing. He lived for the rush of the accomplishment, because that is really the only thing that he could feel that was real, of having won. And if you read up on psychopaths, you'll see that they live for that adrenaline rush because it's really the only thing that they can experience. Dylan Bennett Klebold was born September 11th, 1981, to Tom and Susan Klebold, who had met at Ohio State University. The couple moved on from Ohio State to Wisconsin, where they both earned master's degrees. After this, Tom was able to get a job working in the oil industry in Colorado, and this is what brought the family to Jefferson County, which is where Littleton, Colorado is located. And it's been stated that from the get-go, it was apparent that Dylan was an extremely smart child. He started school a year early, was heavily involved in Cub Scouts as well as sports. It's been said that Dylan Klebold, as a young boy, had a very Huck Finnish attitude. He enjoyed getting dirty and just being a kid, getting into things. One of his earliest friends was a young boy by the name of Brooks Brown. And I want you to remember the name of Brooks Brown, as Brooks and his family are actually going to play an integral part in the saga that is going to unfurl, because unlike many, the Brown family were able to see Eric Harris for what he was due to his own actions, and they did everything that they could in an effort to alert law enforcement to what it was they saw. But at this period of time, during the early to mid-1980s, none of that was in the picture. They only knew that while their son Brooks was a gifted child, Dylan was in a category all his own. Those who knew Dylan stated that he was an exceptionally shy child, and this was something that would stay with him for the rest of his life. Unlike Eric Harris, who could turn on the charm for a given situation, Dylan just seemed to be incapable of doing that. Something else that was noted about Dylan was that he had a ferocious temper. I'm not talking your normal young child temper. I'm talking a full-on explosion of rage that would come over him that frightened everyone that was in its path or happened to witness it. According to Judy Brown, Brooks's mother, the first time she saw Dylan explode was when they went on a crawdad hunting trip. Long and short of it is, Dylan ended up getting his feet stuck into the mud and fell down into the creek, getting himself completely soaked from head to toe, which prompted the other children present to start laughing at him. This in turn caused Dylan to go absolutely insane, screaming at the top of his lungs to stop, stop laughing at me, stop, and nothing that anyone who was present could do could stop him from this manic episode. And it was only after Sue Klebold grabbed a hold of her son and led him away from the others that he eventually did calm down enough to return to the group. In a quote from Judy Brown, "I would see Dylan get frustrated with himself and go crazy. There was no lead up to these explosions. He would simply be going about things in his normal Dylan way when suddenly he would just erupt. Normally, these eruptions came when Dylan felt that he had been humiliated in some fashion." And you do see this type of thing among those who are exceptionally gifted. I'm not talking your normal, everyday gifted student. I'm talking about these individuals who are so far ahead of the curve that even the slightest bit of embarrassment feels like a knock against their intelligence. It was noted after the fact by those who knew them that Dylan Klebold, despite the fact that he was so massively intelligent, always saw himself as being inferior to others. Again, this is a characteristic of individuals with exceptionally high IQs. It's not something that they control, it's just that their brain is so far advanced from the rest of society that they don't fit into any particular mold, and nothing that they do can be good enough for them, because reality is everything that they encounter really bores them because it's so far beneath their level of intellect. These are the kind of people that you see go on to become Nobel laureates and NASA scientists, that type of thing. They have that kind of mentality and that kind of intelligence that anything less than performing at their peak optimal best is not good enough for them. And unfortunately, it's a self-feeding process where they're bored by all of the things around them. They try as hard as they can, but again, they're bored by these things, so then they stop trying hard because it's just not worth it. This stuff is so pedestrian to them. So they continuously work themselves through this loop of massive intelligence coupled with depression equals subpar results, which in turn makes them feel even more inferior, and it's a never-ending cycle and loop. On the home front, Dylan's mother worked in higher education, and his father eventually opened up a business of buying and renovating apartments, which allowed them a fairly comfortable income, and this was something that Dylan apparently got involved with and enjoyed. It is known that upon reaching seventh grade, Dylan had to leave the gifted program behind and move into more mainstream classes, not because he was not intelligent enough to continue on with it. The school just didn't offer it beyond that point. In conjunction with this maneuvering out of the gifted classes and into mainstream academia, Dylan meets Eric Harris at this point, somewhere around seventh grade. In addition to this transition of going into this and meeting this individual who is eventually going to be a catalyst within his life, Brooks Brown, Dylan's erstwhile friend, had fallen out of the picture somewhat as his parents decided that Brooks would be better served by going to private schools. So we have Dylan in the seventh grade. He's really, honestly, alone at this point. He encounters Eric Harris, although the two of them do not become friends, and the person who has been described in some media as his best friend is no longer really in the picture. By the time freshman year rolls around, however, Brooks re-enters the public school system, and it isn't long before Brooks Brown, Eric Harris, and Dylan Klebold are seen as inseparable, with the three boys spending hours together, either running around town or at one of the other's houses playing video games. And it's at this point that it was noted that Eric Harris started to change. While all three of them had been shy up to this point, Eric started becoming the extrovert of the group, very charming and flattering. At some point during freshman year, he ends up asking a girl to homecoming, something that the other two found unfathomable, and more so, the girl accepted his invitation. However, after taking her to homecoming, he and his friends decide to play a prank on the girl where Eric pretended to be dead, lying with his head on a rock with fake blood around it. And this weirded her out to the point that she refused to date or speak with him again. It illustrates that Eric Harris and his friends, at least Dylan Klebold, we don't really know about Brooks Brown, were different from the other students, be it because of their higher-than-average intellects or just because they were built differently. They found humor and amusement in things that others found horrific. And it's at this point that it was later noted Eric's worldview began to change. As I stated, he always dreamed and fantasized about war. In school writings, it was noted that he began to have bleaker visions, visions in which he was the last individual left in the world, the sole survivor, the alpha male, for lack of a better term. Not the normal typical writing of a freshman in high school. And yet, because his work was so exemplary, his family was looked at so highly, and Eric was very good at masking who he really was on the inside. The teachers didn't bat an eyelash at any of this. They simply allowed him to continue on as was. We know about this not only from Eric's writings in school and his personal writings, but because around this period of time, Eric and Dylan, as well as others in Littleton, encountered a new invention known as the internet. Now, I'm sure those of you listening remember a time before the internet existed, but when it did come into existence, it was really very little beyond chat rooms, and Eric Harris flocked to these chat rooms where he could encounter other individuals, more often than not girls. And these girls gave statements describing how Eric was a very gloomy individual with a very nihilistic world view. One individual who encountered Eric during this period of time later stated that when she told Eric that this was a gloomy and disturbing worldview, he replied with, quote, "Yeah, but it's still nice. No people at all. Kind of like everyone is dead and has been for centuries." Eric then poised her with the question of, if everyone else was dead and it was just the two of us, would you repopulate the Earth with me or allow the human race to go extinct? Obviously turned off by his earlier comments, the girl informed him that she would allow the world to go extinct, which Eric informed her was the correct answer before stating, quote, "I just wish I could actually do this instead of just dream about it." That gives us a pretty good idea about who Eric Harris was on the inside. The fact that he was willing and felt comfortable enough to express these kind of fantasies to nameless strangers on the internet without any fear of reclamation or that it was going to come back to him in any way, shape, or form. But it also points us in the direction that Eric Harris was not influenced by the things that were going on around him. There has been a pervasive myth concerning the Columbine Massacre that both of the killers were inspired by the music they listened to and the video games and the movies they watched, when we can see that Eric Harris already had these ideas floating around in his head. They were appealing to him. A world in which nothing existed, and where he had nothing to gain, he simply existed along with it. That is what he envisioned, because while he had a fertile imagination, it was an imagination that was devoid of all of the bright hues and beauty that an active, healthy imagination is filled with. All he saw around him was things that should no longer be allowed to exist because they served no purpose. And this was not created by video games and music or moving around. It is simply who he was. In contrast, as I've already discussed, when we look at the writings of Dylan Klebold, his are filled with feelings of self-loathing and despondency, but also with visions in which women adore him. That is a key central factor to the things that Dylan writes about, is that he longs for a woman to love him, specifically a woman by the name of Harriet, who he had classes with, who he fantasized about. And when I say fantasized, I'm not talking about, you know, pornographic fantasies. I'm speaking in context of he fantasized about having one of those, you know, movie-type romances with this young girl where he lives his all for her and she lives her life for him kind of things. What it boils down to is Dylan longed to be accepted, but he was not, or at least he perceived that he was not accepted and that these things would never happen. And long before he and Eric Harris came up with the idea of taking out their school, he was expressing these emotions and these feelings. And they were real feelings to him. He deeply felt these things. They controlled him much as most people are controlled by their emotions. And again, it was a self-fulfilling cycle of having these emotions, being elated, then reality coming crashing down, or if not reality, his perception of reality, which further forces him into a deeper depression. And it was because of all of this that these things, at least on Dylan's end, happened. Now, it's noted that during his freshman year, Dylan did encounter an individual who was going to become one of his best friends. It was an individual by the name of Zach Heckler, who, according to Dylan, got him. He understood they were on the same wavelength, both personality-wise and intellect-wise, and the two of them gelled perfectly together. So, this Zach ends up becoming the third or possibly fourth wheel within this group that consists of Eric, Dylan, and Brooks. And now you've got all four of them spending a lot of time together, but Dylan is feeling closer to Zach than he is to the other two because he's found that kindred soul. And they did the normal things that teenagers do. They went to ball games, they went bowling, they went to the mall to try and meet women, with Eric consistently taking the lead because he had no fear and he felt nothing of shame or of depression because of a perceived bad personal image. Dylan ends up joining the theater program, opting to work in the background on lights and sound, whereas Eric detested that type of thing as he saw it beneath him in a waste of time. Eventually, Brooks Brown ends up falling out of the picture, which we're going to talk about in the next episode, everything that went on between with that. And now it's Dylan, Zach, and Eric. And Dylan and Zach were as thick as thieves, and Eric was really the head of them. The three of them could be snarky together, as they were all extremely gifted, but there was a bond between Dylan and Zach that did not, at this point in their freshman into sophomore year, that did not exist between Eric and Dylan. Like I said, Dylan viewed Zach as cut from the same cloth, and I don't want to say that he saw him as a soulmate, because people hear that word and automatically they envision connotations of a romantic nature, but they really meshed well together because they were so similar. They had a similar worldview. They were interested in the same things. They enjoyed one another's company. And Eric was kind of the bombastic one of this trio, the one that was willing to take risks and add excitement to the things that they were getting into, because that is what he craved, whereas the other two kind of just muddled through things. Eric was the firebrand in the middle of them. But they also enjoyed, you know, having these online lives, particularly playing video games. And it's been noted in numerous periodicals and research papers that the game that they really focused on the most was the video game Doom, wherein you're a space marine fighting the hordes of hell in space. And it's known that at least Eric was so good at it and so computer literate that he eventually began making his own mods of the game, which during the mid-1990s was almost unheard of for a high school student to be involved in, but he was really into this type of thing, and Dylan appears to have enjoyed it as well. It's been said that the two of them were equals as far as their ability to play this game online went, that there were very few who could match either of them. Now, it was during sophomore year that Eric Harris began to exhibit changes which were in stark contrast to the rather friendly, preppy individual that they had known beforehand. It's at this point that he starts wearing the combat boots and the camouflage pants. It wasn't long before Dylan began to adopt a similar mode of dress, as did other individuals within their circle. With this new change in appearance, it was noted that Eric became more boisterous, some said more aggressive, others said more playful, but certainly more flirtatious, although he still viewed himself in a manner different from what others did. Many girls later stated that they found Eric to be cute, however, he himself disagreed with this. Eric had a very unique view of himself. He did not like the way he looked. He referred to himself as a runt at being only 5'10", whereas Dylan was somewhere around the 6'5" mark, lanky, and I'm not picking on the guy, although fuck him, he's a scumbag for what he did. He was not an attractive individual. Large forehead, kind of, you know, distended jaw, massive nose. He was not attractive. It's that simple, whereas his friend was seen as attractive by the girls of that time. It also had to do with the way that he presented himself, the aura that he gave off, as you will. And it was during this year, their sophomore year, that what became known as the Trench Coat Mafia was born. An individual who was in the school, who was a junior, at least according to the story, wanted to go as Dracula that year, but could not find a cape, so instead he settled on a leather duster. Other kids in school saw this, took note of it, and many others began dressing in this fashion. I want to take note here that we had a similar thing happen in the West Memphis 3, wherein individuals started wearing these long trench coats or dusters to school, and Damian Echols latched onto it, later claiming to have been a member of this supposed trench coat mafia, whereas people in the West Memphis Marion High School said that there was no such thing. It was just a bunch of kids who got the idea to start wearing them and did. In Columbine, they acknowledged that there was a so-called trench coat mafia. It had only existed for a year, and it was really nothing more than a joke. Kids got these outfits, and they liked the way it looked because it made them stand out to everyone else, so they affected this manner of dress and kept it up. However, by the time that the senior year was going to roll around, the only people really wearing this mode of dress is going to be Dylan and Eric. So he wanted to make that distinction there, that yeah, there was a trench coat mafia, but it wasn't some sinister group, which is, at the time of the school shooting, what the media tried to portray it to be. It wasn't that at all. If anything, it was just an idea that started out as a joke that took hold, but it was not an organized thing of, you know, person A is the leader of the trench coat mafia, and they do this, this, and this. It was high school kids having fun and attempting to express themselves in a manner that was different from those around them. We're going to call the episode here. We're just shy of an hour, and I have recorded two other episodes today, the first one being episode 12 of the West Memphis 3, and the second one being the first episode in the next case, and I am fairly fried, and my voice is as well. My patrons, I hope that you're enjoying this, and I hope you are looking forward in what is to come over the next few weeks as we continue this exclusive deep dive. Again, I cannot thank you guys enough for supporting this show. Until next time, stay morbid.